This is Jay Thiemeyer for KBOO Community Radio talking with Maude Barlow, the Canadian water activist, head of Council of Canadians, the largest public advocacy organization in that country, founder of the Blue Planet Project, author of 16 books, the winner of the Swedish Award, the Right Livelihood Award, also known as the Alternative Nobel. Among the 16 books is Blue Gold, which came out several years ago, and the latest book, Blue Covenant, subtitled The Global Water Crisis and the Coming Battle for the Right to Water. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much, Jay. Pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. I would like to start with the question you pose in the first chapter. Where has all the water gone?
Well, that's my favorite question, because it takes a long time for us to get our heads around the fact that what we all learned in grade 6 about the hydrologic cycle isn't true. We all learned that there's this finite amount of water. It goes around, finite at one level, but infinite because it goes around and around and around, gets evaporated, goes into the clouds, comes back to us in the form of rain, and we can never run out of water. That's what we all learned. And our teachers weren't lying, but what they didn't know was what we're just learning over the last, really, decade. And that is that our collective abuse, pollution, displacement, and management and mismanagement of water is actually changing the hydrologic cycle and is actually reducing the amount of rain that we're getting in places where we need it. Real simply, because, you know, obviously time-wise, you know, this is a very long story, but the story is this, that as we pollute surface water around the world, we're taking water from so people don't have access to it, particularly in the global south. We are using modern technology to pump out groundwater. I call it groundwater mining, way faster than it can be replenished by nature. Or we're taking water from lakes and rivers and watersheds by pipeline, and we're piping it to great big megacities. And if those megacities are anywhere near the ocean, they dump it in the ocean, and so it doesn't get returned to the land. We're exporting a lot of water out of our watersheds with what's called virtual water, which is virtual water trade, where you use your water to grow something or produce something that you then export. So you're not technically exporting the water itself, but it's embedded in the product. United States sends about a third of its water out of the United States every day, out of the country, in the form of virtual water trade. You're the biggest virtual water trader in the world, even though you have lots and lots of problems in some areas. And we're also paving over water retentive landscapes with our urbanization, you know, bad kind of urbanization, and particularly, again, where there's slums and so on. So what happens is that if the rain doesn't have somewhere to fall where it can go through the process, as in vegetation, forests, grasslands, and so on, it can't go down into the soil. It can't replenish the groundwater. And, in fact, the vapors blow away and you start to get desert. Best example of that is China, which is using all of its water to, you know, make all the running shoes and toys for the world and so on. So they're not leaving that water in watersheds and not using it to grow food as much anymore. And as a result, they're creating an area of desert the size of Rhode Island every single year. So this, in all of these ways, that with our displacement or you know, growing food in a desert, as in the American Southwest where there isn't any water. Now I just read about a theme park that's been planned for Arizona where they're going to have water falls and white water rapids and water waves so big that you can surf on them in the middle of the desert in Arizona. So this displacement of water from where it's needed in nature, where it was put by nature, to where we want it to be, where we then often poison it, is actually causing the world to run out of clean water. It's not that it's running out of water, but we're running out of accessible clean water, and the demand is rising at an exponential rate, and the supply is decreasing at an equally exponential rate. And we have a crisis on our hands, the global freshwater crisis, that in my mind is way more serious than the energy crisis. We're going to be able to find alternatives to energy, and we can all stop going so many places. But there's no answer to the global water crisis that's coming to a community near you. Is already in communities in the global south now, where, you know, more children die every day of waterborne disease than HIV, AIDS, malaria, car accidents, and more put together. So it is, in my opinion, the greatest ecological and human rights threat of our time. And I try to tell in the first chapter of the book how this displacement and abuse and pollution of water is actually one of the major causes of climate change. It's not just that water has been affected by climate change, which is also true, but that it is also a cause of climate change by creating heat and deserts from below and interrupting the health of the hydrologic cycle.
And yet, very few people are really aware of the degree of the crisis or that we're really approaching a tipping point, that we need to act now to avoid a very bleak future that you describe in that first chapter of if we don't act, what to look forward to in 20 years. I'm thinking of, for example, the situation in Tibet now. The coverage does not even address the fact that the Tibetan Himalayas, of course, are the source for 10 watersheds which provide water for half the globe's human population. And yet we don't see that as an element of this whole Tibetan crisis.
Well, I'm really glad you raised it, because one of the things that really struck me when I wrote the book was, and again, I compared it to what I saw, what I discovered when I wrote the first book 6 years ago on the water crisis, was that water has suddenly become a global water security or national security issue, particularly for the big superpowers, United States, Europe, and China. And these countries, particularly China and the United States, are now looking outside their own borders for new water supplies, because you can't have the, you know, economic growth that they're having in China without, you know, minerals and energy and now water, and the United States can't maintain its military and commercial superiority without water. China is building a great big pipeline to take water from that watershed that you're talking about, from the Tibetan Himalayas, and going to take pump that water, huge amounts of that water, again back to China for, you know, their industrial production, which continues to grow unabated, even though everybody knows what it's doing to the environment there. And that is one of the key sources of contention between the people of Tibet and the Chinese government, claims that that's their water. Well, it's, as you say, it's the water that supplies the great river systems that supply water to all of Asia. So, I mean, I see coming conflict, you know, between superpowers, with superpowers taking over water from smaller countries and smaller communities. We in Canada are quite aware that the United States is probably eyeing our water. So this is going to be more and more of an issue in the years to come, what kinds of conflicts we're going to have around water.
It's interesting to watch what Bush has done and not done. He's taken a very bellicose attitude regarding the Great Lakes, basically being very confrontational with Canada as opposed to working with Canada around a collaborative, cooperative solution to the water in the Great Lakes.
That's true, but I have nothing good to say about our governments either in terms of the Great Lakes. We have collectively allowed the Great Lakes to be seen as a great big sink, a great big waste sink for our chemicals and our pollutants. Only 3% of the species there are natural species, native species. The rest are invasive species. We take about 1 trillion gallons of water a day out of the lake, and believe me, we are not putting 1 trillion gallons back in. So there are now industrial bore wells that go as deep into the aquifers and the springs feeding the Great Lakes, particularly Lake Michigan, that go as deep into the ground as Chicago skyscrapers go up in the air. And they are pumping the water so hard that for the first time last year, they reversed the flow of water in Lake Michigan. It flowed the other way. Mm. And this is just incredible. I mean, we're you know, we have mismanaged those Great Lakes, and now there's a lot of talk in the Southwest about accessing those lakes by pipeline, because people are in industry are continuing just to invade the Southwest, you know, or Florida. My goodness, there's over 1,000 people a day moving into Florida, 1,000 people a day. And they're pumping their groundwater so fast that big sinkholes are opening up and swallowing houses and in some cases even whole shopping centers.
Right. You had, in talking about bottled water, you talk about Florida groundwater, which is rare, being bottled and shipped elsewhere for sale. You point to commodification and the transnational's role in dealing with the water scarcity problem, as opposed to governments stepping in, intervening, and public service element addressing the problem. I'm also thinking of Bush again, that instead of standing up and addressing the crisis regarding water, he has invested in, and tell me if this is the case, in 100,000 acres over the Guarani aquifer, the huge aquifer in South America. He's invested in a huge tract of grazed land in Paraguay. So he's aware of the investment potential, as are the transnationals. Could you talk about the transnationals, please, their role?
Well, I sure can. It's one of the big concerns that I have, is that as water becomes more scarce and as the demand grows, and as we all know, there's no substitute for it. We need it for life and everything we do. The private corporations in the world have become very interested in water. That's why I called my first book Blue Gold, that suddenly they are extremely interested in our water all over the world, wherever there's clean water left. It basically takes three or four forms. One is the big utility companies like Suez and Veolia, where the World Bank has basically forced third world countries to accept these for-profit corporations if they're going to get any funding from the World Bank. And the record is appalling with these privatizations. And there have been privatizations in the United States as well, but the experiment's really gone a long way in the global south. And I document in the book how, with the 15 years of privatization of services and wastewater services in the global south, there's been a net decrease in funding from the global north, because they said, well, the private companies will invest. Well, the private companies didn't invest. They're just there to make profit, and they do not provide water for anyone who cannot pay for it. And millions and millions and millions of people are dying because they cannot afford clean water. And if they had money, they would be not dying. Then there's the bottled water industry, which put something like 50 billion gallons of water in plastic bottles last year around the world and distributed it out. 95% of those bottles do not get recycled. They get thrown in garbage heaps or burned or end up in the ocean or our rivers and lakes and so on, where they become a huge part of the plastic problem that we have in the world. And, you know, we continue to buy bottled water even though we know I don't know where you'd have to be that you haven't read that your tap water in the United States is safe and clean and better and safer than bottled water, but people still buy this stuff. When I see people buying bottled water on sale, I think, don't do that. It's 6 months old is why it's on sale. You're drinking chemicals and fossil fuels. So the bottled water industry is another one. And I've just recently been in New England as part of this book tour, and the bottled water companies are everywhere. I call them water hunters, and they are water hunting for water mines. It's not like sustainable use of an aquifer. These companies like Nestle and Poland Spring, they come in, they take as much water as they can from an aquifer, and when it's gone, they move on. They pump it till it's dry. So that's a second area. The third, and this is really what I do have an indictment very strongly of the Bush administration, there's billions of dollars being put into the whole water reuse industry. Now, of course we need to do recycling, and of course we need to have a good technology to clean up our water. But what I'm really worried about is who's going to control water, as these big companies like General Electric and Dow Chemical and GN and ITT, it's called, and Suez are all getting into the water recycling industry. And we're not putting the onus on conservation. We're not putting it on source protection. Go ahead and pollute the water, because you know what? There's so much money to be made from cleaning it up. That's what worries me. And the lack of oversight of these companies and the question about who's going to own that water when the actual water is done, when the actual cleaning is done, why wouldn't General Electric say, well, we own it, just the way Coca-Cola says it owns the water it's taken from a tap, right? And so now we have a huge dependence and a huge reliance on the miracle of technology, desalination plants. There are 25 to 30 of them planned for the California coast alone. They're expensive, polluting behemoths, and they are the worst technology. They're what you do when you've run out of all options, which we have not yet. But there you have the government of California and the government of the United States putting so much emphasis on that. Now that we're talking about nuclear-powered desalination, because the fossil fuel use for regular desal is so heavy. Nanotechnology, what's called toilet-to-tap technology. This is a really, really dangerous new development, and I worry very much that if we continue to see technology as the only answer, we're just going to give up on the most important answer, which is what they call the soft path: conservation, source protection. All the things that we can do in our daily lives to stop destroying water. And then I guess there's another form, and that's the actual trade in physical water, which is happening now, the trade in water rights. But you actually get trade in sewage water now. Many of the southwestern states, in order for a developer to get a permit to develop, they have to show that they have water, access to water for the development or the industry or whatever. And so they're now buying up sewage water from other municipalities or other industries. So now now we're actually trading the physical water. So in many, many ways, we're kind of circling water, and I have a section in the book that talks about water on the open stock market. Again, when I wrote Blue Gold, there was no water being traded per se on the stock exchange. Now there are dozens of indexes. Water is the hottest commodity right after energy and hydroelectricity. It's out there.
Blue Gold was published only 6 years ago.
That's right. I saw a tremendous change between when I wrote Blue Gold and when I wrote this book. All the things we predicted in that book came true, but it was quite stunning how fast it's happened and how advanced I call it a corporate cartel of water, and how fast that's taken place.
And of course, it's even worse in the third world, where the transnationals are buying up water resources and public resources, and placing meters on, controlling the distribution through meters, requiring people to pay for their water. Cochabamba is one of the most
very big problem. I remember standing in a place called Orange Farm in Johannesburg, South Africa. It's one of the big townships there with about a million people in it, and it's, as far as you can see, there's poverty and burning tires and garbage and, rats in the gutters and pit latrines, no running water, little shacks that people live in. And yet, finally, there's this miracle of these pipes coming up one to a block, and pipes and taps. But between the pipe and the tap is a state-of-the-art water meter, and the only way to get at the water is to go get your electronic key charged up by paying exorbitant prices, going back, touching the water meter, and then you can see, for as the thing runs, every single drop of water is calculated. I mean, that's what we're dealing with. So it's, a lot of us talk about the need maybe to start putting a conservation price on water, to start charging properly for the services, because we also have a free-for-all in many ways. But if we do that, we need to bear in mind what's happened in the U.S. or in the Global South, but also in Detroit, where metering caused the cutoff of water to 42,000 families in Detroit a couple of years ago, and then they sent the social services in and took the kids away because there wasn't any water. We need, if we're going to charge the true cost of servicing and providing good water, and it may be that we need to do more of that, we must not use that as a tool to turn, to exclude people who need. Everybody needs water. No one must be excluded, and therefore we're really fighting for this notion of the right to water, and that water must be kept in public hands. And if we're charging for it, that money must go back to infrastructure repair and so on. One of the very important roles that I play is that I'm chair of the board of Food and Water Watch in the United States. It's the kind of premier organization defending public control of food and water. And one of our campaigns is for a national safe water fund, clean water fund, that would be a designated fund at the national level to provide money for infrastructure repair across the country, because the federal government, not just under the Bush administration, but it's been cut back for a while, has been steadily cutting funding for infrastructure. So you download the problem to the municipalities, and they don't have the money to do it. And we could fix a lot of problems if we took the old pipes and we repaired and cleaned up our infrastructure, which is going to cost a lot of money. But let me tell you, it costs a lot of money when people get ill from dirty water. And there's we need to invest in safe public health care with the delivery of water, clean water services by governments and through pipes that have been cleaned up and repaired through this infrastructure fund.
This is Jay Thiemeyer for KABU Community Radio, talking with Maude Barlow, the Canadian water activist. One of the solutions for the current economic downturn in this country was promoting investment in infrastructure repair and the jobs that would create. And, of course, that got sidelined. Portland is doing some work around its transportation system, and they're discovering all these. The pipe system is just deteriorating to a really critical point, as an example. I would like to get into your concluding chapter, which poses an alternative future, and you focus on water conservation, water justice, and water democracy. Water justice, for example, involves women's role globally in bearing the burden of water inequity. Could you talk about this alternative future and the pursuit of the right to water?
Yeah, with pleasure. I called the book Blue Covenant because I really believe that we need to have a covenant with the earth and with one another to protect this most precious thing called water, which is the lifeblood of our planet. And I think we need to start with a covenant with the water itself and with the earth to see that water has rights outside of us to exist, to be clean. Nature has rights as well. And that means conservation. That means changing our patterns of living in many ways. We're going to have to confront the whole notion of unlimited growth and, you know, more stuff and more consumerism, more exports. It is absolutely unsustainable. The earth cannot continue to sustain the way we're living or the new consumers of the world coming on stream every day. We're going to have to change our food production processes, cutting drastically on chemical use, hog barns, big industrial food production, massive exports. We're going to have to think and act more locally with a notion called subsidiarity, so that if something can be grown or produced closer to home, you have policies that promote that. We're going to have to protect water and bring back water into watersheds. That may be one of the most important things we do.
You talk about rain retention.
Rainwater harvesting is incredibly important. And rainwater harvesting we tend to think of for poor African countries, you know, where it's very dry and the water comes only at certain times of the year, so you have to do this. We all have to be harvesting rain in a whole bunch of ways, from rooftop gardens to green centers around our cities to building cities with green spaces and parks and trees. We must find ways to allow water, to bring water back into the water cycle, and to be building within the notion of green, and to keep the rivers or reopen the rivers from deconstructing dams and so on. We've got to start thinking about the way nature needs water to be and how much we've interrupted that. It's terribly important. On the water justice, we in the Global North need to work towards a different kind of system internationally that isn't based on charity. You know, we'll go and dig wells for you. There's a place for that, but it's much more based on the dignity and the rights and the solidarity needs of people living without water now. And believe me, they're the ones on the front lines who could teach us how to fight for water rights. This is going to mean including cutting the debt to the third world. I mean, those debts are crippling so many countries that cannot then provide clean water or education or health care to their people. So we base this on a notion of solidarity and justice, not charity.
You point to...
I,
You point to networks like Jubilee South, Make Poverty History, and Action Aid,
right.
And their role in this, and the necessity of debt relief to intervene in the daily deaths of thousands of children, and that has to end.
It has to end, and so does the role of the World Bank. The World Bank has played a pernicious and really dreadful role in enforcing a program of privatization on the Global South. And what's really the worst about it is that most of these big, powerful northern countries, including Canada and the United States and Europe, they all have public water systems, or most of them. And they've done very well by public water systems, which has led to public health, which has led to a strong economy, you know, and strong domestic policies. And yet they insist on a privatized future for the Global South, and I think it's a form of racism. And I'm very, very, very adamant about the role not only of our governments, but of the World Bank, and then of the World Trade Organization, which locks in through trade restrictions all sorts of things that governments can no longer do to protect their resources or their people. These global institutions have played a very, very negative role, and we need to, you know, really hold this up to our own governments in terms of what they've done.
I would like to, we're coming to the conclusion, and I would like to point out that after painting this bleak alternative, if we don't act, you nonetheless feel hopeful, and that you see being hopeful as a moral imperative, that we need to address this and that there's a collective solution, and that you see these water warriors who are emerging in response to the whole privatization push as the necessary ingredient in all this. Why, to conclude, why are you hopeful that we can address this problem and prevent it?
Partly because I think we have to. when you care about next generations, I have grandkids now, and boy, oh boy, that gives a whole new meaning to an urgency to this fight.
Right.
But I think that water is going to become a catalyst, or has become a catalyst for a new vision. I like to tell about a man who's going to turn 90 very soon in Freiburg, Maine, a little community in Maine where Poland Springs has been destroying the water tables. They're just taking so much water.
Right.
Who was a Republican, right-wing Republican businessman, used to be able to pick up the phone and call the governor and get the governor on the line, and then just got furious with what Poland Springs was doing to his local lake, destroying it literally, and has become a passionate advocate, and, you know, found out that he can't call the governor anymore, and when he finally couldn't get the governor nor anybody to answer him, he put some of the sludge from his lake that's dying, this ooze goop that's coming out of the lake, he put it in an envelope, sent it to the governor, and the police visited him. Well, he's just outraged. And it's been a really interesting thing to watch how this issue of water pulls people from different parts of our society into this notion of the right to water. I mean, you get evangelical Christians who say water is a part of the creation, and nobody has a right to take and destroy this creation. So it's been a really interesting thing to watch all the variety of groups that have come together, saying, look, we might not agree on everything else, but can we start there? And my hope is that water, instead of being a source of conflict, will become nature's gift to us to teach us how to live in peace with one another and in harmony with the earth.
There's a website called Water Warriors. Could you talk about
that? Yes, if you go to foodandwaterwatch.org, and people will get access to tons of terrific information about water, the water issues, both in the United States and around the world.
Well, Maud Barlow, your hopefulness is infectious and inspiring and necessary. And
thank you very much. I am just delighted to talk to you today, and I know that we can do this if we decide together.
It is a collective solution, and you'll be speaking in Portland on April 15th at 7:00. At the First Unitarian Church downtown. I'm looking forward to that very much. It's going to be wonderful to listen to you some more.
Me too, Jade. Looking forward to seeing you and all my friends in Portland.
Right.